wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Kia ora, Alan. How are we?
Hi, Rosetta. I'm all good. And the weather's good too, which makes a difference. Yes.
Indeed. Beautiful day outside. Cool. What have you got for us today?
Well, we've got important stuff today, like how to win the lottery.
Oh, I love that. I'm very excited to hear about this.
Okay, so this is absolutely foolproof. This is a guaranteed way to win the lottery. Absolutely guaranteed.
Hit me.
Okay. Now, unfortunately, it applies to the UK lotto.
Oh,
not
all right.
not New Zealand lotto.
Stink.
But the principles are basically the same.
Mm.
So the question is, how many tickets do you have to buy in order to be absolutely certain of winning something in lotto? Something. Okay, now, the way that the UK lottery works, a little bit different from lotto here, so a ticket contains six numbers.
Okay.
Okay, so here, you know, a ticket's got like 10 groups of six numbers or whatever. So over there, they call a ticket a group of six numbers. Okay, and their numbers go from 1 to 59.
All right.
Okay, so you've got to choose six numbers between 1 and 59. How many tickets do you reckon it's going to take to be absolutely guaranteed winning something?
Now, oh, I don't know.
You've probably read it?
No? Math isn't my strong suit, so I'm relying on the mathematicians to have worked this out for me.
And indeed they have. So there's a bunch of mathematicians at Manchester University who have worked this out. And it staggers me that nobody's worked this out before.
Yeah.
And then you sort of delve a little bit deeper and you think, oh, okay, maybe it's not quite so surprising that they haven't figured this out before because this comes as a result of a 23-page publication.
Mm.
23 pages of mathematics. Yes, it doesn't make for fascinating reading, I'll tell you that. I don't understand. I haven't got a clue about, you know, it's all about Fano planes. If you want to know about these things, which I don't know what they are.
Okay,
I'll admit that. But what they're saying is, okay, so if you're going to win the big one, so if you're going to match up your six numbers with the, you know, with the six numbers that are drawn, then your odds of doing that are one in around about 45 million.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, that's a lot.
So it may surprise you that the number of tickets that you have to buy in order to be absolutely guaranteed of winning something is 27.
Oh. That's really not that many.
It is really not that many. You're absolutely right. And each ticket costs £2 a pop. So therefore, 27 tickets at £2 a pop, 54 quid.
That's a pretty good deal to win the lotto.
Yeah, but now you're missing the important thing. Now, I didn't say win the whole thing.
Oh.
I just said win something.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Now, the smallest thing that you have to do to win in the UK lotto is pick two numbers out of six, out of the group of six, okay? And if you do that, they basically give you a lucky dip. So, you know, you can get a ticket and see if that works and blah, blah, blah. So they start from there and then they go up to, you know, picking all six numbers and winning truckloads and truckloads and truckloads of money. So, you know, as I said, the mathematicians put their mind to it. They published this big, big, big paper, 23 pages long, figured out all the mathematics of it, and then so they wanted to try their theory, basically. And so seemingly they had just sort of finished this big theory and they had a lotto draw on the 21st of June this year, and they looked at the numbers that were chosen on the 21st of June, and had they gone by their theory, bought these 27 tickets, they would have won about £1,800.
Okay.
Okay. But they were just too late for that one, so they went for the next draw, which was on the 1st of July. And they won nothing. So they lost £54.
Okay.
Well, in fact, what they did win was a couple of free spins sort of thing. So they had a couple of ones where they picked two numbers, okay, which gave them the lucky dip and in which they didn't win anything. Okay. So they lost £54 at that stage. But then you're probably all thinking, well, hang on, if you've got this absolutely guaranteed way of winning something, surely
the lotto's rigged.
Surely you must come ahead in, or you must come out ahead in the long run. And the answer is no, you don't. No, because they have everything sorted in terms of that. So you are essentially 99% certain to not make your money back. Okay. Even though you're guaranteed to win something. So so that just shows you how much the odds are stacked against you in in Lotto. So and these 27 tickets or 27 lines that I'm talking about, they're just, you know, combinations of numbers. So they start off 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6,
mm-hmm.
1, 2, 3, 4, 7, 8, 1, 2, 5, 6, 7, 8. They finish with 48, 49, 52, 53, 58, 59, 50, 51, 52, 53, 54, 55, 54, 55, 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So they're basically just a whole bunch of these combinations of six numbers, 27 different combinations of six numbers, guaranteed to win something.
Right.
So obviously the question is now, how does that compare to New Zealand Lotto?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's differences. Obviously New Zealand Lotto, we only go from 1 to 40.
Mm-hmm.
And the minimum prize that you can win is you've got to get three numbers out of the six, okay? Not that I know anything about Lotto, I don't play Lotto, but, you know, that's those are the rules. So
you mean you don't calculate it every
day? Well, you know, everybody I know says, oh, when it gets up to 35 million, you know, you've got to buy it because somebody's got to win, you know. Well, you know, somebody's got to win every week. But so how would that sort of go with New Zealand Lotto? I guess there's a challenge to the mathematicians listening.
Mm-hmm.
Get out there and calculate it for New Zealand, because these nice people at Manchester, they've put their computer program online, so you can use the freebie version of that to basically figure out how it would be for New Zealand Lotto and see if there's a chink in the system.
Okay. Mathematicians, if you're listening, go and solve the Lotto so we can all be rich.
There we go. Yes.
Cool. What's next?
Okay. Well, we're sort of sticking to a mathematical sort of thing, sort of. But it's a big happy birthday today to a guy by the name of John Comrie.
Happy birthday, John Comrie.
Who would have been?
Who is he?
He would have been 130 years old today.
Oh,
yes.
Wow. Okay, so he's dead.
He is well and truly dead. But, okay, I'm going to be honest and say I'd never heard of this guy before.
Hmm.
Possibly partially because I am not an Auckland student and I have never been to the Auckland Maths and Stats Computer Lab, which is named after him. So he was an alumnus of Auckland Uni, born in 1893, so born in Pukekohe, so he's a good Kiwi, and so he went to Auckland Uni and he majored in chemistry.
Yay.
Got the MA in chemistry, which, you know, is just a great starting position for your entire life, you know, get out there and do chemistry, folks. And this was during the First World War. So, of course, like all patriotic folk, he graduated in 1916 and then went straight off to war. Went to France, lost a leg, unfortunately. And then at the end of the war, he went to Cambridge University and he had always been interested in astronomy since his time at Auckland. Because they used to have apparently a telescope on top of Old Government House or somewhere around there. And he got interested in all of this, and his interest was in occultations.
What's that?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So occultations are where the moon or planets go in front of stars.
Okay.
And so basically they travel across the front of stars. Mm-hmm. You see the star disappear and then you see it reappear and everything. And you can calculate when these things are going to happen, and as you can imagine, the calculations involved in such sort of things are really massive, and they were even more massive way back in the early 20th century. So when they did everything by hand using these things called logarithms, which you are all too young to remember. I'm sure you never got taught logarithms at school, did you? Using log tables? You did? Oh, just did? Okay. Yeah. But heaps and heaps of different types of calculations involved in that. And as I say, all done by hand. So this guy, John Comrie, sort of thought, well, hang on, there's got to be a better way of doing this. And there was. There absolutely was. And he sort of thought mechanical calculation might be a lot easier. So, you know, sort of instead of doing it all by hand, you've got adding machines and, you know, stuff like that. Sort of. Sort of those sorts of things. And what he thought of that could help all the calculations with these things called punch cards. Again, something that you're too young to remember, because way back in the early days of computers, computers used these punch cards where you would punch holes in cards and input them to the computer, and that would basically tell the computer what to do. It's way, you know, so these days you just got a keyboard and you type in your commands and blah, blah, blah. Back in those days you had to, and it took forever to punch these little things out. And that was basically giving the computers instructions. So he was thinking of doing this sort of stuff in around about the 1920s, 1930s. And the whole idea of punch cards had been around for maybe 100 years or so. They used them in weaving. The Jacquard loom used punch cards to make patterns. Mm-hmm. They used punch cards to store data, like for the US Census in about 1890 or something like that. So all of these things, but they'd never been used for computation before. And he was the guy, basically the first guy, that said, right, let's use these punch cards for calculations, for computations, and it'll make them quicker and it'll make them easier. And he became deputy director of the National Nautical Almanac Office in the UK after he finished his PhD. And they make all sorts of nautical tables, you know, sunrise, sunset, and, you know, longitude, latitude, all of that sort of stuff, all involving, you know, heavy, heavy, heavy calculations. And so he basically said, look, you know, we're going to get rid of all of this silly doing it by hand stuff. We're going to use these punch cards. We're going to do the calculations way, way, way faster. And he did. And then once he'd sort of modernized that service, he went and started the world's first scientific computing company, which he called the Scientific Computing Service. Great name. And he was then doing sort of tables of, like, where the moon's going to be all the way up to the year 2000, all of the sort of astronomical stuff and everything, all of which was heavy, heavy, heavy computational stuff. And he just basically revolutionized the whole science of computation. And he really was the forerunner of sort of the modern computer and the use of punch cards in the modern computer. So, you know, I was amazed to hear of, you know, just what a real bigwig in this sort of area of science he was. And, you know, I absolutely never heard of him. He was made a fellow of the Royal Society in 1950, and then he died a few months after that. And, you know, as I said, they've named the computer science lab after him here. And
quite rightly.
You know, I think it's fantastic. So happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
I mean, you know, that's, yeah, always, always neat to hear of sort of New Zealand scientists who've flown under the radar to a certain extent. So somebody should write a book.
Someone should make a movie.
Oh, there we go. Good idea.
Cool. Well, you've actually thought out the order of things quite well, because we're sticking to a space theme for the next one.
Oh, yes, indeed. I give this a lot of thought. Yeah. And we're going to answer the question today that has never been asked before. Can you fry in space?
I've been wondering. I think about it daily, actually.
So you often wonder how some of these sort of scientific ideas come up, but there's a bunch of folk in Greece who thought, right, we need to answer this question, can you fry in space? The reason being, and it's perfectly reasonable, you're on your trip to Mars, it's going to take 9 months, you want some nice fresh cooked chips, don't you?
Yeah.
Because, you know, that sort of dried food's going to get a bit bloody boring for 9 months. So can you make your lovely deep fried chips in space? Because remember, no gravity. So does that change things?
Well, and you wouldn't really want hot oil going everywhere.
Well, that is one thing. You're going to have to keep everything contained, aren't you? Yeah. And so, you know, they were thinking, okay, there's been lots of studies on how to grow things in space, how to grow food in space, but not really how to prepare food in space. And that's sort of, you know, that's where this question came from. And the answer is, basically, long story short, yes, you can fry in space.
Okay.
You can. How did they figure this out? Okay, so they do a bunch of flights for the European Space Agency, where they do these sort of parabolic flights in planes where you go up, 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 up really quickly, and then down, down, down really quickly. And at the top, you're essentially weightless. Okay, so you don't have to go into space. You just have to sort of fly a particular way, and you can simulate, basically, low gravity or microgravity situations. Okay. So they sort of booked a spot on these flights. They set up a frying apparatus complete with high-resolution, high-speed cameras, which was looking at the potatoes and the boiling fat and all of that, and the boiling oil and everything. And their question was, okay, so when you are frying things, you're frying your potatoes, water comes out of the potatoes, okay? Because and it comes out as water vapor.
Yeah.
bubbles all over the place. And these bubbles, because we have gravity and because the bubbles are less dense than everything else, they rise, mm-hmm. okay? And that allows all of the fat, the deep frying fat, to cover all of the potato, okay? Mm. It's not stopped by these bubbles. So they're thinking, okay, if we're low gravity, these bubbles might stick to the chip and they might stop the fat getting into the chip and it just won't be any good.
Yeah.
So that
this is really important science.
Absolutely it is. This is vital stuff, you know, government funded and everything. But as I said, you know, as I'm sure you'll all be very, very happy to hear, no, you can fry in space because the bubbles, seemingly, they just do, again, they don't stick to the chip. They fly off into wherever they fly off into. And again, that allows complete coverage of the chip by the hot oil. So, you know, if one of you folk listening are on the first craft to Mars and
don't worry,
fish and chips, yes, indeed. So that's I think is a good note to end on.
Yeah, you know? I think so.
Good use of science.
Great, good use of science. Well, thank you, Alan. Thank
Pleasure.
You, Motet. Thank you, science. Thank God for chips on aircrafts.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.